Editor.
Oniki wahi.
Gigawabamin. Soko seni denit e. Ninen yuji hina.
Eko se.
Kakuhut dao. We'll see you again.
CFRC 101.9 FM has launched its annual funding drive to raise $25,000 to support station operations, news and creative programming, and upgrades to our recording and performance studios. You can make a difference. Visit CFRC.ca right now and make your gift. Get a tax receipt through Queen's University or get sweet CFRC swag and enter to win our weekly raffle draws featuring gifts from amazing local donors. More information at CFRC.ca. Thank you for your support.
CFRC 101.9 FM has new social media. Find us on Instagram and Facebook at CFRC Music and keep up with the latest announcements about our programming and projects. Follow us today at CFRC Music.
Hello and welcome to Viewpoints. On today's show, in New Brunswick, Green Party MLA Megan Mitten says she'll keep an eye on Susan Holt's newly elected Liberal government.
You know, the devil's in the details, and so I'm looking forward to seeing some numbers and seeing some timelines around some of the promises that the government is making.
To Montreal, where a Mohawk group says McGill University is to blame for the removal of a white pine peace tree planted on their grounds just a few days ago.
A reconciliation is not just some rhetoric on a website, but reconciliation comes with reparations. And so we are taking our form of reparations in regards to our right to control what happens on our homelands, and this is our homelands.
High-speed internet will soon bridge the gap between Manitoba's rural communities and larger markets.
We deserve the same rights and services and programs like any other Canadian that enjoys living in a free world.
Nanaimo's new poet laureate is looking forward to sharing world poetry and language with his community.
I think I'm just at a juncture in my life where advocating for the arts just feels really, really compelling and really important.
Local farmers who want to stay on the cutting edge of agricultural innovation could get help from the Experimental Acres funding program. And St. John's artist Cheryl Crowley introduces the community to her art project, Our True Selves. Welcome to Viewpoints Local News Nationwide.
You are on the air with Viewpoints. Listen to all our stories on frequencynews.ca.
Thanks for joining us. I'm Boris Chassaigne, and I'll be with you for the next half hour and in good company with our journalists posted across the country. We kick off the show in New Brunswick, where the newly elected Liberal government will be closely watched by Green Party MLA Megan Mitten. We're going to need to do multiple things to address multiple crises, says Mitten. The Sackville Green Party MLA says there were no surprises in last Tuesday's throne speech outlining plans for the Holt's Liberal government. Mitten says she will continue to focus on health care, affordability, and infrastructure concerns in the New Brunswick legislature. Here's part of Erica Butler's conversation with Mitten as she shares her reactions to the throne speech.
Megan Mitten, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
The last time we spoke to you, you did say you were feeling a bit hopeful about the beginning of, you know, getting back in the legislature and starting to see things happen. Are your hopeful feelings being rewarded by what you see happening so far?
Well, I mean, I'm still going to hang on to that hope. There are some things in here that at first glance sound good, but, you know, the devil's in the details. And so I'm looking forward to seeing some numbers and seeing some timelines around some of the promises that the government is making. And so I'm going to be looking for the details of what they're going to do in terms of healthcare, for example, housing, and other things like that.
Do you see some of these initiatives as, you know, like the more important and things that you'd like to see happen as soon as possible?
I don't think anyone's surprised to hear me say we have a major crisis in healthcare. We have an affordable housing crisis, an affordability crisis, and we have a climate change crisis. And so with this situation we are in, we do need some transformative action to be taken. They are mentioning collaborative care clinics, which is something that, you know, I've been calling for years. We already have one that is really starting to develop in Tantramar, which I'm glad about. I'm seeking more details on what they mean. We will need infrastructure money for that. And so I'm already talking to the Minister of Health about that and about him visiting Tantramar and Strait Shores to see what's going on and how, you know, the Minister of Health can support what we need in our communities in terms of healthcare.
On the affordability front, we will be seeing a 3% rent cap come in. That's close to what was in the Green Platform, what you were proposing. Do you have any cautions or things that you'll be looking out for as that comes forward?
So that bill will be tabled on Wednesday, and so we'll see the details of it then, but it is similar to what we were pushing for, and I mean, we've been calling for a rent cap, for years. The other piece of what I really want to see are protections for tenants, against retaliation. I'm planning to meet with the Minister of Housing to discuss, you know, what else is needed and offer suggestions about where we can go to better support nonprofits and cooperatives and non-market housing, because that's really where we should be focusing right now. Some of the things that I'm going to be bringing up this fall will be healthcare, absolutely. Housing is another thing. This Throne speech was really light on transportation and infrastructure talk. I do have a meeting with the Minister of Transportation and Infrastructure next week, and on our agenda will be things like the Chignecto Isthmus, which was not mentioned in this Throne speech, the Wheaton Covered Bridge, as well as Route 955 being part of their capital asset plan. And so even if some things don't come up in the legislature, I'll be working on them outside of the legislature in meetings with ministers, for example. I'll keep my eye on things and hopefully we can do another update to once things have rolled out a bit.
Thanks very much.
Thanks, Erica.
Hey, I'm Anastasia Avakumova in beautiful British Columbia, and you are tuned to Viewpoints.
To Montreal, Quebec, where a group of Mohawk women and their supporters gathered at McGill University on Saturday, November 16, to plant a white pine sapling in a call for peace. But by Monday morning, that tree was gone. The group, who call themselves Ungwe Hungwe Kunungwe, says McGill is likely to blame. The ceremony was an unsanctioned commemoration of the pro-Palestine encampment that once stood in McGill's lower field, and a call for peace both in Gaza and on the ancestral territories of the Haudenosaunee people where McGill University now stands. The university did not confirm that it was their workers who uprooted the sapling. McGill, however, stated that their commitment to the spirit of reconciliation is enduring, but they retain the right to determine how university property is used. Details with Jules Bugiel in Montreal.
A group of Mohawk women gathered at McGill on Sunday to plant a white pine sapling. But by Monday morning, that tree was gone. The group says McGill is likely to blame. The day before, Mohawk land defender Ganatsikwa Selin-Gabriel spoke to the crowd of over 100, explaining that the pine tree was planted as a symbol of peace.
As the title holders to the land, the women decided that we are going to put a tree of peace here. We are here as well because on our homeland, we saw students being beaten up, pepper sprayed, silenced. That's not going to happen on our watch.
The pine was planted on the edge of McGill's lower field, just steps away from where a pro-Palestinian encampment once stood before being dismantled by private security this summer. Here's Zaina Karim speaking on behalf of Students for Palestinian Honor and Resistance, one of the groups behind that encampment.
We, the student movement, would like to thank the women of the Ganyangahaga Nation for this gift of peace, the planting of the Great White Pine. We are together through these difficult times, and we honor this gift by raising our voices with yours for peace and justice.
In a statement, the university confirmed that they were aware of the plan to plant the tree, an action they cited a number of reasons for not approving. The most fundamental being that, quote, the university's authorization is required for the modification of its property. But in an email obtained by CKUT, McGill senior administrators Fabrice Labo and Christopher Manfredi also told the group that McGill's reconciliation efforts are, quote, carried out in partnership and consultation with the traditional and elected leadership of local Indigenous communities. The group in question is not affiliated with the Mohawk Nation at Ganawage. Still, Gabriel told CKUT that it's not up to McGill who gets to speak for Mohawk people.
You know, we, as the title holders of this land, do not follow the colonial status quo of Band Council. And we are able to speak for ourselves as sovereign individuals under a sovereign nation, sovereign peoples. It's not up to McGill to decide who's going to speak on our behalf. It's totally not up to them. Just as we would never tell McGill who's going to speak for them.
Personally, I disagree with the fact that a settler institution should be dictating the terms of reconciliation when they are the ones actively still occupying our territory.
Speaking now is Guru Hanorun, a graduate student in anthropology at McGill, who was also part of the Mohawk or Ganangahaga Nation. They told CKUT that the removal of the tree isn't an isolated incident, but speaks to a larger trend in how McGill approaches Indigenous students generally, and the Mohawk community in particular.
This has not been a place where I feel necessarily welcomed or supported by the administration because of the way that they are oriented in their relationship with my people, which I guess sounds a bit abstract, and I wish I could explain it more clearly than that, but it feels very much like McGill imposes itself on Ganyankahaga students, on Ganyankahaga people that live in the island, that live in Ganawage, Agwazasne, Ganasitage. An example I can give maybe that's a bit more concrete is this semester I wanted to take a Ganyankahaga class, and I had to persuade the graduate program supervisor in anthropology to let me take the class because it had an undergraduate course code and I'm a graduate student, and I had to argue why I should be allowed to learn my own language on campus. And that was definitely really frustrating, especially seeing all these emails that come out and McGill publicly presenting itself as being in front of reconciliation, as leading reconciliation.
McGill told CKUT in a statement that the university's commitment to reconciliation is enduring. Online, you can find the progress they've made on 52 calls to action, established in 2017. But they've also been in a prolonged legal battle with a group who call themselves the Mohawk Mothers. It's a group of women who are fighting to have McGill conduct an expert-led search of the new Vic site for unmarked graves. A key request in that fight has been for McGill to treat the women as leaders and partners in that search. Many familiar faces showed up on Sunday for a ceremony with a similar demand.
Reconciliation is not just some rhetoric on a website or creating programs where there's certificates of social work or certificates of teaching. But reconciliation comes with reparations. And so we are taking our form of reparations in regards to our right to control what happens on our homelands. And this is our homelands.
McGill refused an interview with CKUT and did not by press time confirm that their workers were the ones who removed the sapling. I'm Jules Bijal, reporting with the Local Journalism Initiative. Thanks for listening.
Do you have questions or comments? Our email is radio@frequencynews.ca.
The city of Nanaimo is welcoming its new poet laureate. His name is Neil Sirkin. Sirkin is an English professor at Vancouver Island University, and he has an extensive list of published works, including his newest chapbook entitled Ruined, published in 2023. Sirkin says he is excited about his new role and his two-year term as Nanaimo's poet laureate. His new job will start on December 1st, and soon after, on December 5th, he will kick off the Harborfront Library Poetry Showcase, accompanied by Youth Poet Laureate Paige Pierce. Lauren McKenzie in Nanaimo, British Columbia.
I was obsessed with the idea of playing music live, and that was my goal actually when I went started at university. I just wanted to be a musician, and then I took a modern poetry course. It was my first ever university course in English, and I fell in love with the difficulty or the complexity of it. And so I started writing my own stuff.
He says it took another 10 years before he started sending out publication inquiries for his work and fell more deeply in love with poetry and the act of writing it.
I think my first book, which was called On High, came out in 2018, was still just writing a series of almost love letters to the poets who had kind of lit me up. And it wasn't until this second collection that came out in 2021 called Unbecoming, where I really found that my own voice started to feel true, I think. And that came down in a lot of ways to having a child. So when my son was born, I just suddenly realized that a different kind of frankness was required of me. I wanted to just show up in the world in a way that I could be proud of to my son.
He says he applied for the Poet Laureate position as he is invested in getting his neighbors and wider community into having conversations about the language they use and how poetry allows people to find new ways to express themselves.
And I just want to invite people into that, because often I hear, especially around poetry specifically, that people are like, oh, it's not for me. I don't really know how to engage with that form or that kind of writing. And I always just see it as our most precise language. And so I think of it in every conversation where we're trying to convey something we really mean. That's our opportunity to speak to one another more deeply.
He says that as the Poet Laureate, he's interested in shifting the idea of offering poetry to the community by instead inviting the community to engage with it themselves.
So my goal is to kind of sprinkle the wider city with little opportunities to stop and reflect on our own histories and contexts while we're in a definitive place. So thinking about the histories and the contexts of this place alongside what we bring in our own stories.
He says having a Poet Laureate for the city is important because now is the time to pay attention to the weight that words have and to engage with how complex they can be to convey a message.
And so I think that that's something that everyone should be invited to engage with and to reckon with, because it's a tricky reckoning. And I think it can also just lead to so many illuminating and inspiring moments in our personal lives when we think about the role of the poem in our own vicinity. So I want to bring that to the city. I want to advocate for it. I think I'm just at a juncture in my life where advocating for the arts just feels really, really compelling and really important. And I just feel so delighted that I get to have the opportunity to put that forth. I'm so excited to hear the language that y'all are going to create together. And I'm so excited just to hear the stories of your lives as you start to craft your own poems.
This is Neil Sirkan reading a poem from an almost completed manuscript he is working on.
This is a poem called Endurance. And it's about looking toward the future. Endurance. Were grief a state of healing, and not the act of paying attention to what will have been, what's now disappearing from the earth, I would teach you to believe in reflourishment. Instead, you must learn endurance in the face of all that won't be saved. My chick, who hatched among the egg-lumped coils of a dozing snake, while I clung to the nest and sang.
Hello, I'm Candace Vetter in Embrun, Ontario, and you're tuned into Viewpoints.
A $38 million investment from the Canadian federal government will bring high-speed internet access to 14 rural and Indigenous communities in Manitoba. The announcement was made in Winnipeg by Dan Van Dahl, Minister of Northern Affairs and Minister responsible for the Canadian Northern Economic Development Agency. Edward Albert of Norway House Cree Nation Broadband Incorporated feels that this announcement could help level the playing field and open the door for new businesses and investments that might only have gone to larger urban centers such as Winnipeg or Brandon. And David Lee Roy Muswagen of the Pimicikamak Communications Corp says he's excited about the opportunities high-speed internet brings to his and other First Nation communities, and says his business could soon be able to compete with other Winnipeg markets. Ryan Funk in Winnipeg, Manitoba.
This initiative promises to enhance access to vital online resources, foster economic growth, and boost community safety, providing a foundation for new businesses and investments in areas traditionally overlooked in favor of larger urban centers like Winnipeg and Brandon. Edward Albert of Norway House Cree Nation Broadband Inc., one of the key partners in this effort, explains.
connectivity is really something, I think, for our small community, our rural community, to connect with our big cities. You know, I think it's important that we send our services out to the world and what we have to offer. And I think that's important.
He emphasizes the potential of internet access to promote tourism and other economic opportunities.
Through internet, I think there's opportunity there for everybody in our community, even our businesses, definitely. I know that we just opened up the health center in our community, and I think it's important to have our connectivity in that area.
David Leroy Muswagon of Pimichickamack Cree Nation and Pimichickamack Communications Corps sees this as a long overdue step toward equality in services for Indigenous communities.
It's been a long time coming. This is an 18-year journey where we started in 2006, and we ran into all kinds of roadblocks and red tape and everything, but we were persistent. We didn't give up on our dream of providing objective standard communications infrastructure to our people. For far too long, there was disparity between Canadian standards and Indian standards. So we worked hard to bring this up to here, saying we deserve the same rights and services and programs like any other Canadian that enjoys living in a free world.
His organization, based in Cross Lake, has built its own infrastructure from the ground up, equipping them with the knowledge to differentiate themselves from larger providers.
Our goal is to eventually start off small, baby steps, and we're going to learn as we roll out, right? There's things that are going to work. There's things that are not going to work. So once we stabilize a solid foundation for a PIMCOM corporation, then we'll start gradually moving out to different, we'll start investing and dealing with different markets on different economic opportunities where we see value for money, and where we see a value to benefit the corporation. And our long-term goal is to become a big player 20 years from now, where before I get too old and die, I want to see at least 100 of my young people working and taking ownership of their corporation and running it themselves.
The Honorable Dan Vandell, Minister of Northern Affairs, announced the initiative in Winnipeg, emphasizing that internet is no longer a luxury.
We must make sure that everyone has access to high-speed internet all over Manitoba and all over Canada. That's especially true in isolated communities, northern and rural communities, especially Indigenous communities that have historically been underserved.
The upgraded infrastructure will revolutionize daily life, improving telehealth access, enhancing online education, and enabling digital business opportunities. It also connects Manitoba's rural workforce to urban centers like Winnipeg, reinforcing the potential for remote work.
I was Northern Affairs Minister for about a month after the pandemic. Then the pandemic was declared. And within a few weeks after that, I would have early morning meetings in Yukon, late morning meetings in Northwest Territories, and late afternoon in Nunavut. And we were able to communicate and to work. The workforce itself, as you know, now we have a hybrid model where 50% of the time, or 2 or 3 days a week, people work at home when they work for the federal government, provincial government, and I would think the city as well. So there's that, the ability to work from remote places.
Funded through the Universal Broadband Fund and Indigenous Services Canada, this initiative is part of a federal commitment to connect 98% of Canadian households to internet by 2026, and all by 2030. While only 85% of Manitobans currently have reliable high-speed internet, these projects, led by Indigenous communities, aim to create long-lasting benefits by prioritizing local leadership, expertise, and economic empowerment. I'm Ryan Funk.
Hi, this is Erica Butler in Sackville, New Brunswick. You're attuned to Viewpoints.
to Ontario Now, where farmers looking to try new techniques or crops can now apply for a $3,000 grant offered by the county to help local farmers stay on the cutting edge of agricultural innovation. The intent of the Experimental Acres Funding Program is to help local farmers mitigate the risks of applying new regenerative agricultural practices, such as using cover crops to prevent soil erosion or building new greenhouses using new green technologies. Details with Arlene Dowell in Fergus, Ontario.
Experimental Acres lets farmers apply for grant funding of up to $3,000 to help with projects that could benefit their operations. Agriculture coordinator with the county, Jordan Griggs, says they are always looking for a wide variety of projects. She says they usually fall into three categories.
So we've had a lot of crop or planting projects that might include things like planting cover crops for the first time or looking at a more diverse mix of cover crop seeds that could be planted, as well as intercropping or other unique cropping techniques. We also have animal-related projects. So this is often rotational grazing or trying to bring animals back onto land where they've been removed from for a while. And then other projects kind of that don't fit neatly into those two categories, we put into innovation. And we've had a few different unique projects go through this stream. We've had some of them including tarping to break hay instead of using tillage to reduce the impact on the soil.
She says regenerative agriculture can be practiced in as many ways as there are farms. The project that was piloted in 2022 has produced many success stories. Greg says she continues to learn and appreciate the vision of area farmers.
So we worked this past year with a farm called Black Dog Acres in Guelph, Aramasa. And Doug, the farmer there, was using spent distiller's grains on his hay field and to reduce his reliance on fertilizer input. So it was a nice way to work with a local business to collect the distiller's grains, and then Doug was able to try out this practice on his farm, and we did some soil testing in the spring, and we'll be going back next spring to compare to see if it made any difference on the soil health parameters that we measured.
Generally more popular with smaller farms, Grig says all sizes of farming operations are welcome to apply.
When we say that we're a small-scale grants program, small-scale can mean a smaller farm or just a subsection of your farm so that you can test something out before expanding it to your whole operation.
She says applications are being accepted until January 19th and says in the past, funding for these projects has ranged from $500 to $3,000.
And in that process, we just ask about the current practices, what you would like to do as your experimental acre, and your approximate budget. And that helps us sort of know how many projects we can accept into the program.
Arlene Dowell with the Local Journalism Initiative.
And to close the show, St. John artist Cheryl Crowley just launched a new exhibit at the St. John City Market. Her community-based art project entitled Our True Selves was produced in collaboration with members of the community. Each person created art pieces on a small wooden disc to express who they felt their authentic selves to be. In the end, more than 90 illustrated wooden discs were produced and will be on display at the City Market for the next few weeks. Yonako in St. John, New Brunswick, spoke with her.
I asked them to think about who was their most authentic self inside, whether they showed it on the outside or not, and also to channel their five-year-old who loved to just play and make things. And we did three community events with all kinds of different art materials. And with those two ideas in their minds, children and adults then just had a great time decorating individual discs in the way that spoke to them at the moment. There was a Pride Market and so many people came and decorated there, and we ended up with 95 discs. The children were more instantly up for it. The adults, some of the adults, it was a little bit harder to ask them to think of their five-year-olds, because we get so conditioned as adults about how we should do things and shouldn't do things, and the idea of just taking materials that call to them and playing with them and making something that was abstract sometimes took a little bit of persuading.
So that's it for us this week. Thanks to our journalists, Arlene Dowell, Yona Ko, Erica Butler, Jules Bugiel, Lauren McKenzie, and Ryan Funk. Our national editors were Conrad Fox and Victoria Fenner. Viewpoints is brought to you by the Community Radio Fund of Canada with the support of the Local Journalism Initiative and, of course, your local radio station. Thanks for giving us a voice. By the way, remember to check out all our stories on frequencynews.ca. I'm your host and producer, Boris Chassaigne. Happy to have you with us this week, and until the next, ciao.
Welcome to Campus Beat. I'm Dinah Jansen. It is now 5:30 here at CFRC 101.9 FM, and we are coming to you today at a special time to discuss breaking international news of interest to members of the Queen's community and the Greater Kingston community at large. This morning, November 26th, the news was alight countrywide with announcements from the incoming Donald Trump administration that he intends to impose 25% tariffs on goods from both Canada and Mexico heading into the U.S. To learn more about these issues and potential impacts of this proposed policy, we caught up today with Dr. Nicholas Lamp, assistant professor in the Faculty of Law, cross-appointed with the School of Policy Studies, and who also serves as the director of the annual Queen's Institute on Trade Policy, a professional training course for Canadian trade officials that is hosted by the Queen's School of Policy Studies. Thank you for joining us today. We hope you enjoy the conversation. Let's dive in right now with our chat with Dr. Nicholas Lamp. Thank you so much, Nicholas, for joining us in CFRC today. A lot of big news coming out of the United States talking about the potential increase in tariffs to 25% from the new or incoming Trump administration. But before we jump in, can you tell us about yourself and your area of expertise in the Faculty of Law?
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. My area of expertise is international trade law. Before I joined Queen's in 2014, I worked for two years at the World Trade Organization in Geneva, helping the members of the appellate court of that organization to settle trade disputes. And my PhD research was also on international trade lawmaking. So it's very much my passion is international trade. And it's, as you can imagine, it's been a busy few years in that area.
Indeed. And what drew you to the field? Why are you so passionate about it?
Well, I was always fascinated by globalization. I'm originally from Germany. Germany is a big trading nation. And as a high school student, I spent a year in Brazil. And I saw that globalization was perceived very differently in Brazil. The role of multinational companies was seen much more critically. And that really spawned my interest in understanding how globalization is governed. And at the time, I felt the best place to go to understand how globalization is governed is to the World Trade Organization, where the law that governs globalization is made. And that's where my academic interest in the field comes from.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for sharing those insights with us. And now getting to our big topic today, can you tell us a little bit more about the back history of trade between Canada and the United States in recent years, for example, under NAFTA or even more recently?
So Canada, North America is a very integrated trading space, and that, of course, goes back to NAFTA, goes back even further to the Canada-US Free Trade Agreement, which was negotiated in the late 1980s. But what has happened over the years since NAFTA came into being is that we have developed very integrated supply chains across the North American continent. So if a car is produced in Canada or the U.S., it's not really just produced there. The parts of the car will have moved across the border several times. And so that's really what makes it special. It's one of the regions of the world, North America, which has these integrated supply chains. You see the same phenomenon in Europe. You see the same phenomenon in Asia as well. But that's we've kind of grown together almost. You can imagine it like a plant that has grown together, which makes these threats to tear up these supply chains or to impose these trade barriers so threatening for us. And so we've been here before in the first Trump administration. We know, of course, that Donald Trump threatened to blow up NAFTA the first time he was in power. That ultimately evolved into a negotiation of a new agreement, which has been widely praised. And Canada came out of that negotiation in much better shape than many had feared.
Okay, thank you so much. And now, big announcements just this morning all over the news here on November 26th related to these proposed tariffs, a 25% tariff on Canadian goods from the Trump administration, who will be taking office in January 2025. I wonder, Nicholas, if you can provide an overview to the best of your knowledge of what has happened and the motives behind this new proposed policy.
Well, what we know about Trump is that he loves tariffs. He has said that tariffs are his favorite word in the dictionary. And so nobody was surprised that he was going to come up with a proposal to impose tariffs. And in fact, he had announced that it was part of his platform. But this is, I think, the proposal that we saw on a Monday evening is not seen as a very serious proposal by most people. And there are two reasons. One is that it's not really a trade policy objective that he's trying to achieve. His objective that he says why he's threatening these tariffs is that he wants Canada and Mexico to stem the flow of migrants and drugs to the United States. And so he's tying this tariff threat to a non-trade objective. I mean, of course, there is some trade element to the flow of drugs. But it's really a different policy field. It's of course the policing of the border by Canada and Mexico, and the policing of the drug trade by Canada and Mexico that is at stake here. So and this it's typical of Trump to do this to tie trade to non-trade objectives, but it's not really a proposal for a new trading relationship. Right? He's using the tariffs as a stick in order to achieve these policy objectives in other areas. And it's, of course, the yardstick is also very unclear, right? So it's relatively easy for Trump to declare victory if Mexico and Canada propose to take some measures in these areas and then kind of back off from this threat.
Okay, thank you so much. And now, while it might have been something we might have expected from the Trump administration, the Canadian dollar did drop to the lowest level today since 2020 following this announcement. Can we expect more downward trends for our Canadian dollar moving forward? What do you think?
Yes. I mean, of course, any of these threats that Trump makes, whether they're ultimately serious or not, is hugely damaging for the Canadian economy, right? Simply because of the uncertainty that it creates, right? So even if there's only a 20% chance that these tariffs are actually going to go come to place, you'll see Canadian companies thinking twice about before they invest in Canada rather than the United States as a result of it. So I'm not denying that there's real economic damage that follows from these tariffs. We also have to keep in mind, of course, that they are economically suicidal, especially between Canada and the United States. The main export that Canada has to the United States is crude oil. And so imposing a 25% of 60% of U.S. oil imports essentially would boost inflation in the United States. It would do huge economic damage to the U.S. Economy. And so that's why it's unlikely to happen. But still, the uncertainty that he is creating with this is damaging first and foremost for Canada.
Thank you so much. And now I wonder what the potential impacts may be for Canadian business and industry overall. What are your thoughts?
Well, of course, what a tariff does, it makes the goods more expensive. And for US consumers means they will be paying more for Canadian goods. It will create upward pressure on prices in Canada, in the United States. And as a result, the most likely outcome is that US consumers are going to purchase less of Canadian goods. And so as a result, Canadian businesses are going to suffer. It will have an impact on employment, on economic activity. There's no question about that. A lot also depends on how the Canadian government is going to react, right? And in the first Trump administration, when Trump imposed tariffs on Canadian steel and aluminum, the government retaliated dollar for dollar by imposing tariffs on U.S. Steel and aluminum. And that would, of course, if the Canadian government decides to retaliate, that would, of course, worsen it, the impact for Canadians, because then prices would also go up. Prices on the U.S. products that we purchase, like the apples or fruit, all the goods that we get from the United States. So far, the Trudeau administration has not said that they will retaliate, whereas the Mexicans have said so. And so that's very much we have to wait and see which tactics or strategies the Canadian government is going to employ. I think the fact that they have not come out with an announcement of retaliation shows that they don't really believe that these tariffs are going to come, because in past instances, the Canadian government has been very quick to spell out the consequences for the U.S. administrations. They've held back this time. In fact, instead, Trudeau gave Trump a call, which apparently was a constructive one. So that shows me that I think the Canadian government has some hope of averting this particular type of this particular round of tariffs.
Right. And now, of course, we may be facing a federal election sometime soon here in Canada. And Poilievre himself had said that retaliation may be necessary, or he would retaliate if necessary, should he become our new prime minister in Canada. So this potential retaliation insofar as slapping on tariffs on American made goods as well. So what does this look like for the average everyday consumer then, let alone our industries?
Well, it very much depends on how the retaliation is done. In the case of steel and aluminum in the first Trump administration, the Canadian government chose to just retaliate in those sectors, essentially mirror the U.S. approach one-on-one, in order to show we're just reacting. We're not trying to escalate here. If the Canadian government chose to kind of again mirror the U.S. approach and impose tariffs on all U.S. goods, that would be hugely destructive. It would drive up prices. It would drive up prices of inputs for businesses, and of course, drive up prices for consumers. So I very much hope that the Canadian government wouldn't do that. That would be foolish. It would be economic suicide. What I could imagine the Canadian government doing is look at non-essential goods, but often which goods that still have a big symbolic significance, like U.S. alcohol imports, for example, and hit them with prohibitive tariffs. Right, instead of 25%, just hit them with 100% tariff. And Canada is very good at identifying goods in the U.S. economy, where tariffs will really hurt the U.S. and hit the political pressure points. So they look at the swing states, they look at vulnerable U.S. Senators and congressmen, and they target the goods in those districts. And if the Canadian government manages to target goods which are not essential to Canadians, this could be retaliated in a politically painful way for the United States without doing too much damage. So I think here we have to have confidence in the Canadian government's ability that it will make sure to minimize harm for Canadian consumers while still trying to really hurt the Trump administration.
Thank you for that. And now I wonder, too, about potential impacts on inflation and interest rates as well. Many industries, many businesses, right down to the local level, but also homeowners and people who rent from landlords are impacted on a daily basis by rising interest rates and the fluctuations that we have seen in inflation, particularly in the last couple of years as we've climbed out of a pretty perilous pandemic. What could be the outcomes here that we might want to be thinking about in advance?
I think it's hard to tell because we have two countervailing forces, right? On the one hand, we would have upward pressure on prices if U.S. imports from the United States are hit with tariffs, and so they become more expensive for Canadian consumers. On the other hand, if there is an impact on Canadian economic activity from the U.S. tariffs, with the result that's a slowdown in economic activity, that would put downward pressure on prices. And so there would be an incentive then for the central bank to lower interest rates. Mm-hmm. And so it's very much a question of how these two forces balance themselves out. And so essentially what we have to worry about more is the potential slowdown in economic activity than the potential inflation from, again, hypothetical tariffs on U.S. products.
Okay, thank you for that too. Appreciate it. Anything else you'd like to add before we close, Nicholas?
Yeah, so what's really disappointing about this way in which Trump has articulated these tariffs or come forward with this tariff threat is that he doesn't really articulate a vision for how trade relations should change, because there's really something really problematic going on with China. China is an incredibly competitive economy. It's taking away a market share in ever more industrial sectors. So there's really serious questions about what the future of the international trading order is going to be and the future of North America as a trading region. And so many are hoping that the Trump administration will come up with creative proposals or constructive proposals in this area. For example, his Treasury Secretary, Scott Bessent, has an interesting background, interesting thoughts on how the international economic order could change. And so those who are hoping that Trump would come forward with some constructive ideas about how to address something like the U.S. trade deficit are obviously disappointed that it seems like he's just using tariffs in this knee-jerk way to get his policy priorities in other areas. So obviously the jury is still out. We don't know what he will actually do and whether he will not end up in a more rational place as he did in the during the first administration. But this was not a good sign. Let's put it that way.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Nicholas, for joining us here on CFRC to talk about these issues emergent just today in international news and trade. We really do appreciate your time. Thanks so much.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.
And thank you again to Dr. Nicholas Lamp, who joined us at the very last minute today to chat about this breaking news. We'll turn it over now to CFRC's campus news reporter Ali Al-Safadi with his own story on student-led campus news publications, their role in amplifying student voices, fostering creativity, and building a sense of community. Over to you, Ali.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Campus Beat. This is Ali Al-Safadi, CFRC's campus news reporter, and welcome to my segment about student-run publications on campus. Publications on campus are a cornerstone of university life, offering much more than just an opportunity for students to hone their skills in writing, editing, and design. They serve as platforms for storytelling, advocacy, as well as connection, showcasing the unique voices, experiences, and perspectives of the student body. Today, we'll be diving into why campus publications matter and how they shape university culture, as well as their enduring value for both students and their broader community. Let's start with what makes campus publications so special. These outlets, whether newspapers, magazines, or literary journals, are powerful tools for self-expression and dialogue. They reflect the diversity of thought on campus, tackling a wide range of topics from breaking news and political issues to creative writing and personal essays. Through their content, they create space for important conversations and help foster a culture of critical thinking and awareness. Campus publications also play a significant role in documenting the history and culture of the university. They serve as archives of student voices, capturing the stories, challenges, and triumphs of each generation. Years from now, someone might flip through an old issue and gain insight into what mattered most to students during a specific time in the university's history. One of the standout publications at Queen's is Muse Magazine, the ultimate home of creativity at Queen's University. Founded in 2012 by three artistically passionate students at Common Ground, or CoGro, this magazine began as an ambitious idea scribbled on lined paper. Its first issue, The Explosion, launched in February 2011. Setting the stage for a publication dedicated to celebrating innovation, fashion, and the beauty found in unexpected places. Over the past 12 years, Muse has grown into a powerhouse of artistic expression with a huge, well-rounded team, 23 editorial print issues, and a reputation for pushing creative boundaries. Recently, the Muse team has expanded its reach by launching a new online media platform that reflects Muse's evolution, cementing its place as a leader in showcasing student talent at Queen's. Muse magazine strives to be more accessible to students, making their issue free for everyone. They host events throughout the semester to make this possible. Muse Mini Desk and Muse Coffee House are two staple events that highlight some student artists and musicians. Most importantly, Muse Magazine is going to be launching their 24th issue just a couple of days from now, on Thursday, November 28th at the Mansion. Tickets to the launch party are now on sale. If you're interested in learning more, make sure to check out their Instagram at MuseXQueens. Another staple is Collective Reflections. Collective Reflections, or CORE, is a nonprofit, student-led publication and media platform that operates as a committee within the Alma Mater Society's Social Issues Commission. Collective Reflections was created after the merge of some smaller publications: the Queen's Feminist Review, Culture Shock, Outright, Heads Up, and Able. CORE strives to honor its founding vision by showcasing work that resonates with the spirit and values of its creators. They are committed to IEDIAA+, indigeneity, equity, diversity, inclusion, anti-racism, and accessibility. And they also aim to represent the full diversity of the student body. As an anti-oppression, anti-racism publication, CORE emphasizes intersectionality and solidarity across various identities and experiences, including feminism, anti-racism, queer identity, class consciousness, accessibility, and overall well-being. This year, Collective Reflections is working on Volume 12. Under the theme Existence. Existence is everything, and everything is existence. Each person exists through their thoughts, beliefs, history, identity, basically through all the elements that make their presence unique and irreplaceable. Based on one of their recent posts, Collective Reflections is dedicated to diversity and inclusion. They ask you, how do you exist? So if you want to make your voice heard, they exist to showcase your voice and your work. If you're interested, their submissions are now open. The submission link can be found in the bio of the Social Issue Commission's Instagram at Social Issues Commission. Another reason campus publications are so valuable is the professional and personal growth they offer to contributors. Students who get involved in these outlets develop practical skills that are directly transferable to future careers. Whether it's conducting interviews, managing deadlines, collaborating with a team, or mastering design software, the experience is hands-on and real-world. It is also a great way to build a portfolio that showcases their abilities to potential employers. And let's not forget the community building aspect. These publications bring people together, writers, editors, artists, and readers, creating a sense of belonging and shared purpose. They become spaces where students can connect over common interests, share ideas, and contribute to something bigger than themselves. Campus publications are, at their core, an essential part of what makes university life vibrant and dynamic. They give students a voice, build connections, and capture the essence of what it means to be part of an academic community. So the next time you pick up a campus publication or scroll through their website, take a moment to appreciate the hard work and creativity behind it. It is more than just a magazine or a paper. It's a window into the heart of the student experience. I hope you enjoyed my segment about student publications. Make sure to tune in to Today in YGK to hear me talk about the Equity Town Hall happening on Tuesday, November 26th. During this town hall, some important topics are to be discussed, such as accessibility and student rights, equity and indigenization, financial equity, and student voice. It's a chance for students to talk about issues that they see as priorities to administration. As always, this is Ali Safadi, CFRC's campus news reporter. Make sure to tune in, stay informed, and we'll see you next time.
And thank you. Coming up now on this week's Release Radar, in partnership with the Kingston Music Office, we're pleased to present a new single for Maruna and the Sirens' upcoming concept album on addiction and recovery. City Hotel is a country-inspired tune that delves into the social costs of addiction, recounting four violent, racially motivated attacks in Ontario following the 2016 U.S. election. The band's sound is enriched by Doug Tielli's guitars and Sevi Sherman's slide guitar, creating a striking contrast between the song's heavy subject matter and its melodic atmosphere. Catch Aruna and Michael Broadhead at Musiki with Oscar Evans on November 8th, and again with the Caledonias at Next Church on November 30th. Want to be highlighted next time? Complete the Release Radar submission form on the Kingston Music Office website or via visitkingston.music on Instagram. In the meantime, stream City Hotel on your favorite platforms and enjoy it here now on CFRC 101.9 FM.
CFRC 101.9 FM is hosting its first annual radio-a-thon in support of our annual funding drive on Wednesday, November 27th. Starting at 8 a.m., we'll have 24 hours of live programming with your favorite Wednesday regulars and specialty programming from other hosts. Tune in to hear the fun, the chaos, and everything in between while we bunker down with the CFRC Ghost.
CFRC 101.9 FM has launched its annual funding drive to raise $25,000 to support station operations, news and creative programming, and upgrades to our recording and performance studios. You can make a difference. Visit CFRC.ca right now and make your gift. Get a tax receipt through Queen's University or get sweet CFRC swag and enter to win our weekly raffle draws featuring gifts from amazing local donors. More information.